Hello and welcome to Django Chat, a fortnightly podcast on the Django web framework. I'm Will Vincent, joined by Carlton Gibson. Hi, Carlton.
Hello, Will.
And this week, we're very pleased to have Carl Meyer join us. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thank you for coming on.
Again, thank you for joining us. Maybe could you just quickly mention your backstory? You're a big name in the Django world, but for those who don't know you, how is it that you've come to be on our podcast?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know.
Besides, we asked you.
you emailed me and asked me to come on. No, I guess I started a company in 2008 with my siblings doing a web application development, a consulting shop. And we settled on Django for our backend stack. And so I started building sites in Django, and often fixing bugs in Django was more interesting than building whatever the client needed. So I ended up spending time doing that and got into Django development that way, I guess, originally.
So what version of that, I mean, was that pre-1 when you first started getting involved?
It was pre-1. Let me think. It was post-magic removal. This is going to really be one for the old timers here. It was pre-query set refactor when I first started using Django. It was in the 0.97 days, I guess, which lasted for quite some time.
Well, there's still some people on it, no?
Probably.
Never managed to update. And then you're a major figure, right? Because acting as a fellow as I do now, like, daily I'm trawling through the history of track, and very often I'll come across, you know, comment by comment. How did you get involved in the maintenance and running? Just contributing, or just fixing the bugs, as you said? Or
yeah, just contributing and I guess having opinions. I attended.
That helps, right?
Yeah, and it happened in 2008 when I started the company and started doing more with Django. I was living in northern Indiana, so just an hour or two away from Chicago. And as luck would have it, PyCon was in Chicago that year, 2008 and 2009. So I said, why not? I headed up to Chicago and attended PyCon for the first time in 2008. And so I've been to every one since that actually happened, unlike this year. And yeah, so I guess I attended a number of Django sprints at PyCons for a number of years in a row, and got to know the Django team, and I just became more involved.
Okay.
Well, I think it was 2014 when you joined the technical board. Was that the inaugural technical board?
Yeah, that was the first technical board. I think I officially joined the Django team in 2010, maybe, but then we had kind of the first big project governance restructuring that Aymeric Augustine spearheaded in 2013, 2014, and that resulted in the creation of the technical board structure.
And so you must have been involved in the discussions around the creation of the, say, for instance, the API stability policy and these kind of decisions where the deprecation policy, where, you know, if we are going to change something, we bring it in, we deprecate it 2 releases later, we'll take it out. And that's from my perspective, that's working phenomenally well, especially compared to the early days when, you know, I was using 1.2 and upgrading, and it was always really difficult, right? So perhaps you could give us some light in that discussion, or because for me it's just like, oh wow, it's kind of why Django is what it is at the moment.
Yeah, my memory is that was kind of always the intent from the beginning, that Jacob and Adrian kind of set us down that path. I think at various times we've been more or less successful in maintaining the backwards compatibility that we intend to maintain. But I think that was one of the reasons that 1.0 took so long to arrive, because there was, this idea that 1.0 was the moment when the backwards compatibility guarantees would really kick in. And so there was a hesitance to actually declare 1.0. We wanted to make sure we had all of the everything in place the way we wanted it. And after a while, it became clear that that was kind of a fool's errand, that the APIs will never be perfect. And we were already trying to maintain backwards compatibility even pre-1.0, because in practice it was a problem for people if we broke it. So at some point we just said, yeah, it's time to do 1.0 now. Yeah, but I don't recall a lot of changes or discussions around changing that policy. I could be forgetting something, but memory is we pretty much always had that intent of giving a couple of releases before changing something.
That's interesting, because I'd say it's a different world now from, say, 1.5, 1.6, 1.7, where things were still changing quite a lot, and, you know, for good reasons, and Django grew with that. But, you know, comparing that to, say, 1.9, 1.10, 1.11 into 2.0, it's very easy to update now. And is part of that, do you think, is just the maturity of Django, or do you think?
Yeah, I would put it down to the maturity of Django mostly. I mean, I think backwards compatibility for a widely used library in Python is always tricky, because nothing is really private. And as much as you might try to maintain backwards compatibility, it's very hard to know what people are relying on. And I think in the 1.0 through 1.7, 1.8 era, Django was changing very quickly, and there were major new components being added. And I think that just made it hard to always maintain the backwards compatibility that we intended to. And I would guess that if it's significantly better now, it has a lot to do with just the core parts not needing to change as much.
Yeah, they don't change. Okay, cool.
Well, to circle back to PyCons, I was watching for the second time a PyCon 2012 talk, I think you gave, on Django testing, because there aren't actually that many testing Django talks. Mm-hmm. And one of the things you said in there, which just stood out to me, was write less view code and maybe don't even test it with unit tests, just do with it with functional or integration tests. I wonder, does that still hold up for you? Do you still stand by that? Because I love the line you said, something like, anytime I see a view of more than 10 or 12 lines, it's sort of a smell test, because I feel that way. So I'm just curious, you know, 8 years later, does that sort of general advice still hold for you, or how have your views changed?
Have my views changed? Pun intended.
On testing in Django.
No, I still write short views, so my views haven't changed. I think that's still basically what I believe. I mean, these days, it's been a number of years since I've really written a Django view, to be honest. So in practice, it's not, that particular question isn't an issue for me, but I still certainly believe in pulling business logic out into testable components and isolating it from IO in order to make things testable. And that's essentially what that advice boils down to, right?
Yeah, no, it's fantastic advice. And I'm thinking of doing an in-depth Django testing course at some point. So I'm trying to review to the extent there are best practices, because that's one of them, use PyTest. But it seems kind of all over the map to me, honestly, aside from, I don't see any pure canonical way to test in Django, but yeah, Perhaps I'll find it.
Yeah, it's interesting coming to Instagram and seeing sort of what happens in a very large code base many years later. It certainly highlighted some of the things in early Django's testing frameworks that maybe weren't ideal, like the emphasis on the test client and on writing lots and lots of kind of end-to-end functional tests. And, you know, it's easy to say that that doesn't scale, but seeing in practice how it doesn't scale is another thing entirely.
You mentioned the big I word, so I have to ask. So you came to Instagram, it was built on Django.
Yes.
And then, you know, for me, this is, you know, super interesting topic, because I've never worked on anything like that kind of scale. But I've worked on some big sites, and people say, can you scale Django? I'm like, yeah, of course you can scale Django. But then there's a level above that. So I guess, you know, what can you sort of talk us through the evolution of, to the extent that you can, for Instagram, and how they hit those scaling problems, and that, you know, the approaches that are needed to take and things, because it's something that I think most of us will never see.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I gave a talk in 2016 at Django Under the Hood in Amsterdam, where I really kind of go through a lot of that history in detail. So it'd be an interesting thing to look up if you're curious about sort of the scaling challenges as they came. My memory from the research I did for that talk is that, as you'd expect, I think the ORM was one of the first. Well, there were some kind of funny minor things that hit earlier on. Like, turns out sending an email to the site maintainers every time there's a 404. That didn't scale particularly well. That became evident early on. But as far as big components, I think the ORM was the first one. There was a need, I think, after about a year already to be able to shard the database. And at that point, it was still pre-multi-database, I think. I'm not sure. Multi-database support might have happened around that time, but Instagram certainly didn't have access to it, and there was no real support for sharding databases in the ORM. So Mike Krieger, the founder of Instagram, basically sort of wrote a sharded ORM, kind of a very bare bones sharded ORM, and moved from the Django ORM to that, and then later from that to Tau, which is a graph database built at Facebook, which is what Instagram uses for the primary data store now.
Oh, I recall, I don't know, here's an anecdote. I'm not sure where I heard it, but I believe it to be true, that in the early days, there was a Postgres issue with the space allocated to users was so big that they couldn't figure it out. And I think Frank at RevSys, there was some hack at the time, but helped them with, but just these crazy scaling challenges when I think it was just, you know, the two founders and pushing the limits of software at the time.
Yeah. One of the funny stories that definitely people told when I first arrived at Instagram was in the early days, once Instagram sort of really kind of made it mainstream. And I think Justin Bieber was one of the first big Instagram users. And because of the way that the sharding scheme was done, essentially like a user and all of their media were sharded together, and which makes sense for sort of access patterns, but it caused a bit of a problem when you have sort of very popular users like Justin Bieber would make a post and then everybody, you know, goes to like and comment on that post, and all of a sudden you have a ton of database activity all concentrated on one shard. And that apparently caused, this was before my time at Instagram, but apparently that caused a lot of problems, and sort of memorizing Justin Bieber's user ID was a requirement for Instagram operations for a period of time there, because sort of every time he made a popular post, it was sort of an operations emergency that everyone had all hands on deck kind of thing. But those things are in a lot better shape now.
Yeah, I could imagine similar stories about Twitter, where they got popular users, they sort of pre-populate that in a separate thing. Whereas the average user, not you or me, but like just small people, you'd fetch them on demand because they're not many fetches.
So Python at Instagram, you're wearing a Python Instagram shirt. They're still using Python, but they're not using so much Django. Can you talk about where the stack is today in terms of, is there any Django left in there, and how much is Python as opposed to other backend languages?
I mean, Instagram server is still a big Python code base, it's Django at the core. I mean, it still runs through the Django request handling stack and the middleware and views and URL routing. All of that is still Django. It'd look familiar to any Django developer. Just very big, lots of views, lots of URLs, lots of code. There's a lot of, I mean, obviously the ORM we don't use anymore. The admin is very much based on the ORM, so that's not in use anymore. I mean, there's a lot of components where Django provides kind of pluggable backends like sessions and authentication. And for all of that stuff, we've essentially rewritten the entire system, but we're actually still using the sort of Django API for those things because it's pluggable. So I would call that a success story. I mean, in that we've been able to very smoothly migrate away from the components that no longer worked at our scale, and in many cases without even having to change the client code touching those subsystems, because Django provides this ability to swap out the backend. So yeah, and you know, the Django core request support that we still use, we're 100% async now. So we've had to, already a few years ago, we kind of forked and modified a bunch of that to support async or concurrent handling of multiple requests using async IO. So there have been some changes, but
it's kind of cool that you still got that core request bit in there, because I gave a talk at DjangoCon last year, the one that happened, not this one that didn't. But talking just about that core layer, and there's only like 160 lines in Base Handler, right? There's nothing there. So there's no, the point I made in the talk was there's no room for it to be slow and clunky. I mean, Django sometimes gets described as slow and clunky, but when it's not doing anything, it can't be. It's still doing that same thing that all the web frameworks are doing. So that's really nice. I was wondering, would Instagram at the scale they're at needed to have moved away from Python to a faster language, quote unquote?
I mean, there's certainly discussion of that. Python is not particularly efficient in how it uses CPU, and there would be more efficient languages, and that would certainly save on server costs. But there's also a lot of code that would have to be rewritten, and that also has a cost. So there's certainly always a debate about the pros and cons there. So far, the conclusion has been that we'd rather work with Python and try to improve Python and make it more efficient rather than trying to rewrite all of the existing code in a different language.
Okay, that's cool. And you said improve Python there. So can you, what might that mean? I mean,
yeah, well, I mean, that's the team that I work on now is kind of actively looking at the Python language and runtime and where we can tweak things to get a little more efficiency out of it or more developer efficiency. So one of the projects we've talked about publicly is something we call strict modules. So like one problem that we have with Python is the fact that when you import a module, that can execute arbitrary code, which can do anything. It can go out and talk to the network. It can end up being very slow. It can fail. And when the code base gets very large, and there's really, so you can have all these side effects of import, and sometimes one side effect of importing one module can be a prerequisite for some side effect of importing another module. So they have to be imported in a certain order, and that situation can arise even accidentally over time. But yet the order that modules are imported isn't really fixed or determined anywhere. It's kind of a emergent property of the entire system and all the imports and all the modules. So you end up with this very kind of fragile state where somebody can remove or add an import in some module in one part of the system, and that has a cascading effect of changing the order of imports, and then something can fail just because two modules are being imported in a different order. So and another side effect of that, or another consequence of that, is that if you make a change to a Python module and you have all of these modules loaded and running in your web server, say you're a developer working on the code base, you make a change, there's really no safe way to say, let's just reload the one module and sort of hot patch this one change that's been made. There's nothing you can do that's safe other than start from scratch, start the entire process over again, and begin the entire process of importing and loading all those modules. And you know, when your code base gets very large, that takes 30 seconds, 40 seconds, 50 seconds, a minute, which is a long time for a developer to wait for making a simple change to one view before they can test that view in their browser and see the effect of their change. So something that we're trying to do with strict modules is do some static analysis to restrict what is allowed at the top level of a module. To say, you know, at the top level of a module, you can define classes, you can define functions, you can use decorators as long as they don't reach out and have external side effects. Basically, like, you can do all the things that we normally associate with Python at the top level of a module, but they have to be contained. The only effect they can have is within that module. Once you can guarantee that that's the case, that unlocks a whole lot of possibilities, because now you can just safely re-import modules. It doesn't matter what order modules are imported in, all of these problems go away. So that's one kind of example of a project we're working on, more in the developer efficiency side of things.
Okay, that sounds really cool. When you talk about the static analysis there, I mean, how does that tie into the kind of thing you see with the type hinting that is coming in, and like the Pylance thing that Microsoft have got, that doing the static analysis there, and MyPy and the related tools? Is it
Yeah, it's clearly.
It's the same ballpark, right? You're leveraging those techs.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. It's, so strict modules in particular doesn't make too much use of type hints, but it's definitely all in the same kind of area, which I think is a really productive and growing area right now of figuring out how can we do more advanced analysis and make stronger assertions about what Python code does and doesn't do without actually having to run the code to find out. And so type hinting is one example of that, that we've been very excited about. We started adding type hints to our code base, I think already in 2017, maybe 20. Yeah, I think 2017 already. So at this point, our server code base is basically 100% typed. Everything has type annotations. And we found that to be a big productivity boost for developers and makes the code safer. And so we're looking at, you know, how to further leverage type hints and static analysis to make Python both faster and more efficient for developers.
Okay. And can I ask a follow-up then? Because we had a discussion about whether we would bring type hints, type hinting into Django itself. And we were the conclusion that the technical world came to, well, not right now because it's difficult. And, you know, the technology is still nascent and So if you could give us some advice, like what would you say to, you know, if how is it feasible? Are we going to be able to get Django there? What should we be looking at? Can we start small and grow in? Well, just as your sort of, you know.
Yeah. No, I'm a big fan of typed Python. I think it's an improvement to the language, but I think that the decision the technical board made on that was a reasonable decision, probably the right decision. It is very early days still. I mean, at a place like Instagram, we can kind of go all in on something that's still a little rough around the edges. And our developers are kind of willing to put up with some rough edges in order to get the benefits of typing. But for a framework like Django that is so widely used, I think it does make sense to wait until the technology has matured a little bit and some of the rough edges of usability are smoothed out. So I think that was a good choice. I think, you know, it's always a challenge to bring static typing to code that wasn't developed with static types in mind, because patterns are used that just don't lend themselves to static typing. So I think, you know, it's been fine for us at Instagram because, you know, we don't use the ORM. There's parts of Django that are particularly challenging for static typing that we don't use anyway. So for us, it's been pretty easy to just have some stub files that cover the APIs that we use, and that pretty much covers our needs as far as typing Django itself. It will be challenging to do a good job of typing all of Django, especially given the backwards compatibility constraints. The other thing is when we're typing Instagram code that was written in a very sort of dynamic way that doesn't lend itself to static types, you know, if it's internal code, we can just rewrite it or, you know, change the pattern. And for Django, that's much more challenging because of the backwards compatibility constraints. So I think it would be great if someday, yeah.
You can say, hey, for this code, you have to pass an integer, not int or any.
Right, exactly. And we can just, you know, go through the entire code base and change all the call sites and make sure they all do the right thing and just ship that as a diff. And, you know, you can't ship diffs to all of the code that uses Django in the world. So...
Question I have is, so you talked about what you've been working on recently, but it's been, what, I think five years or so since you've been at Instagram. There's always this, I always have this mystery of when someone like you, so a Django core developer, goes to a large company, it's a little bit of a black hole in terms of like, what do they do there? Like, how does it work? Do you come in and they say, what do you want to work on? Or do they say, you have to do this? Like, how does that evolve, right? When you, I mean, you're focusing on, you know, eking out performance in Python and advantages for developers. But yeah, I'm just curious what your story was like and if there's any sort of standard paths when, you know, a well-known figure goes into a large company and then, you know, isn't doing open source work all the time.
Yeah, I'm sure it varies by company. So I can only really speak to my experience in general, and this would apply to any engineer, not just someone who's coming from an open source community. Facebook and Instagram have a very kind of engineer-driven culture. So, you know, there's a pretty wide latitude for an engineer coming in to pick the teams and the projects that are interesting to them. And the culture is sort of you decide what you want to do, and then you have to show that the things you did had some benefit rather than somebody telling you what to do. So there's a lot of opportunity in that. It can also be a little bit scary. but yeah, so that was my experience coming in, was that there was a lot of freedom to say, well, this is what I'm seeing here. This is what I think is important for us to work on. And so I'm going to go work on that.
One of the public-facing things I saw, I forget how many years ago, is that there was a small team that switched from Python 2 to Python 3 over the course of, I believe, was only like 3 or so months at Instagram, which was perhaps an example of people, you know, wanting to make a change, taking on their responsibility. But I'll link to that post. I mean, it was pretty amazing that even at the size of Instagram's code base back then, a small team was able to do it relatively quickly.
Yeah, no, it was very impressive. That was one of the first projects I worked on. It was already it had just been started when I joined. So it was kind of something that was already happening that was easy to jump in on. And I thought it was important for us to do. So I worked quite a bit on that project. It felt like it took us a while, but I think it was under a year, which is impressive given the amount of code that we were talking about.
For Django, maybe this is just a prosaic question, but so what version of Django, to the extent that there is Django at Instagram, are you running right now?
Yeah, unfortunately, we're still on 1.8. So when I joined in 2016, we were on Django 1.3, which was already quite old at that point. And we upgraded to 1.8. The biggest motivation for that was to allow the Python 3 upgrade, because Django 1.3 didn't support Python 3. So we did the 1.8 upgrade. We did Python 3. And, you know, the problem at this point is just given the amount of Django code that we use, there's some big deprecations that happened in 1.9, 1.10. Things like string views went away, string view names and URL configurations went away. And there's a bunch of new restrictions around like the import of models files. Anyway, some things that would be a fair amount of work for us to adapt to, and there just really isn't a lot of corresponding benefit. I don't think Django's development should be oriented around the needs of a company like Instagram. That's not the 90 or even 99% use case. And so the things that are being done in Django by and large are things that we either already have our own solutions for or just aren't going to be relevant to what we're doing. So I think at this point, given the forks we've already had to make for things like async, the most likely path forward is that we end up pulling in the remaining Django code that we use and just kind of continuing to iterate on it as kind of our own internal thing, rather than probably ever doing another Django upgrade.
Yeah, that's kind of clearly going to be the case, I guess. As you say, it's not even the 99%, you know, 99.9% out. It's like the one in a million. But it's also kind of sad. It's like, oh, you know, a little tear.
Yeah, it's definitely been one of the sad things about the way that my work has evolved over the last 4 or 5 years has been that I'm very disconnected from Django development these days. I don't even really have a clear sense of what's in the recent Django versions because I'm not getting to use them, obviously. So that is a little sad. But you know, I'm still having fun working on Python, so it's all good.
That's fair enough. You'll have to start a side project. I wanted to ask you then, so if you're not getting to contribute to Django and work on Django anymore, what about other things, open source things? Are you able to do open source work? Or
I've made and helped with some contributions to Python itself, some small things in the standard library, and a few other patches that we needed. One thing was we had kind of a silly issue with the way that our development process works. The local development server, we actually run UWSGI, which we run in production and also for local development, but it runs as root just because of kind of legacy of how the operational systems developed. And so it was, if you enabled PYC file creation, it would sprinkle all these PYC files owned by root through the code tree. That obviously doesn't really work. So at some point years ago, before I even got there, someone just turned off PYC file creation for local development. And at some point after I got there, I was looking at this problem of how long it takes to start up the server in local development. When someone makes a change, how long it takes to restart it. And I was like, well, we have no PYC files. So not only are we re-importing all these modules every time someone makes a change, we're actually like recompiling them from scratch because we don't even have PYC files. And that's costing us like 25% time, which is really silly. But then there wasn't really a great solution to that. So I just wrote a feature for Python where you can set an environment variable and say, put all my PYC files over in this other directory somewhere else and just kind of have a parallel directory tree elsewhere of all your PYC files, which works great for us. Now we can do that and we get the benefits of PYC file caching. So that's just one small example of like, and then I contributed that upstream. I think it came out in Python 3.9, maybe 3.8. I think 3.8 came out in. So, a few things here and there with Python, but not as much as I would like.
Okay. And do they give you time? I mean, like, I don't think they still do it anymore, but Google used to have this 20% time or whatever that I don't think it's still there. But do you get that kind of thing, or is it only if it's project related? You don't have to.
Yeah, there isn't a kind of explicit 20% time or anything like that. It's kind of like I mentioned earlier, like anything you work on here, it's like you can do what you want. You just have to, at some point, be able to say, hey, I did something useful this half. So it's kind of up to you how to allocate your time.
Okay, that's cool.
I'm curious about feature flipping at scale. You know, in Django, there's this project called Django Waffle that's really great, but Instagram is a whole different beast. What things crop up, you know, flipping features? Like, I think I've seen Instagram's been playing around with removing the like button in Canada or a whole bunch of countries. Like, what does it even take to roll out something like that?
Yeah, if you ask me about specific features and where they're being rolled out or what's being experimented with, I have no idea. That's like very far away from the things that I deal with on a daily basis. But certainly feature flagging in general is critical. And, you know, not even sort of for sort of big experimental features, but for almost anything that gets rolled out behind a flag so it can be turned off. And in some ways, that's not just about sort of experimentation. It's also just a necessity of working at this scale because the changes to the code base are coming so quickly that there's really no possibility of maintaining a long-running branch for a new feature. So you can't have this development style where you sort of branch and work on your feature for a long time until it's just perfect. And then like a month and a half later, you merge a big branch back in. There's just no way that would work. It'd be a huge
no home run merges. Yeah.
No, exactly. So it really forces you into this sort of continuous integration development style where everything has to land in the same trunk branch that's constantly being rolled out to production in fairly small increments. And so that means if you're developing any significantly sized feature or change, it forces you to figure out how can I do this incrementally and backwards compatibly and have things in a fully working state at every point along the way and, you know, gate the feature off until it's really ready to be rolled out and all that stuff. So yeah, it's a very big, big part of what we do.
So you're not using the ORM, but like the issue there is that always happens is migrations, right? It's migrating the database store and how when you take the field out or when you put it in or
I mean, it's the same issue, just even worse because like, there's no possibility, you know, with a large number of servers and obviously many, many database servers, there's no such thing as like, okay, I'm going to synchronize this code rollout with this database migration and everything will roll out together. Like every change you make to the data store, I mean, first of all, it's a big deal to roll out any change to the data schema, but any change you make has to be backwards and forwards compatible. You always have to have things work. If it's new code running against the old schema, or if it's old code running against the new schema, all that has to work. So that certainly has a cost in terms of attacks on development speed, but it's the only option.
Can I ask how long does it take to run the test suite? You know, I mean, because I know of like small sites that take an hour, you know, because they have an optimizer done this, that, and the other thing. I mean, how does it not take months for a little committed Instagram?
So the good news is that we have a lot of tests, pretty good test coverage. the bad news is that I've mentioned earlier about sort of how early Django really pushed you into this path of writing a lot of kind of end-to-end HTTP tests using the test client. And there's a lot of that legacy still in the code base. So the bad news is that, the good news is we have lots of tests. The bad news is a lot of them are slow tests. When you have a lot of slow tests, you have a very slow test suite. So really, I mean, our only solution to that is that we throw hardware at it. So when we, I literally think that nobody in the world has any idea how long it would take to run the Instagram server test suite end-to-end sequentially one test at a time, because I think it's been 6 years since anyone has done that. Like when we actually run the test suite, it runs sharded out to a bunch of different machines. So like there's like a bunch of machines all running tests in parallel and then sending the results back. And with that kind of a system, you know, we can effectively run the test suite for 15 or 20 minutes, which is good enough. But yeah,
enough to go get a drink, but not, yeah, enough to get a drink, but not so much that you're like on Twitter for an hour in between every.
yeah, exactly. And obviously, I mean, people don't generally run the whole test suite every time they're working locally. Like they'll figure out which specific tests are relevant and run those locally. And then we'll run the whole test suite before we ship it.
So that's something I'm going to keep in mind when people tell me about test suites that take more than 20 minutes. I'll be like, well, I heard Instagram is under 20. So, you know, think about that. I like your point though on hardware though, like, because that reminds me at, the only thing at scale I worked on is Quizlet, which was a top 100 site at the time. And we were on Joyent and had the whole executive team come in and this, that, and the other thing. After a full day, they're like, yeah, you just need more hardware. You know, it's just like the people who wrote it were just like, hardware.
Yep. Sometimes throwing computing power at the problem is the most efficient option.
Yeah. Oh, there's something in a way beautiful, like, you know, from a business perspective, if you can just throw money and solve an engineering problem, that's sort of great, actually.
Yep.
Like, yep, you'd take that.
We didn't talk about Oddbird. I don't know what that is or other things. I mean, maybe it's a bit late.
Oddbird
in the day,
is the company I mentioned that I founded with my siblings in 2008.
Ah, with your siblings.
Yeah, Oddbird is still going strong. I'm not there anymore on a daily basis, but yeah.
They make you work on Thanksgiving, yeah?
I check in with my siblings now and then, see how things are going, if they need help. But yeah, still going well, still using a lot of Django. I think they're up to 6 or 7 people now. So it's if you need a Django application, Django site or application built, and you're looking to contract it out, I mean, Oddbird does everything from the back end to the UI design and kind of figuring out what the user needs are. So it's a great option.
Well, maybe one final question. So we're on video. You're not in California. You're remote. I think you've been the whole time you've been remote at Instagram. Is that right?
That's right.
How has that been? Because my sense is most of the team is there, and obviously now everyone's remote. Yeah. But I'm just broadly curious how, you know, remote learning the last odd number of years and then today where everyone's out of the office.
Yeah, I've been remote pretty much my whole career. So it's kind of like a fish in water. I never really had a big issue with it, even when I was one of the few people remote. I did travel out to the office in California pretty frequently, which I think is important. There's really no substitute for getting to know people in person at some point. And so just to sort of have those relationships with the team, and I think it was important to make those trips out. But on a daily basis, you know, we have good video conferencing. Pretty much everybody's already using, you know, the funny thing is like the Instagram or Facebook offices are so big that half the time people are meeting over VC anyway, just because they're in different buildings and they don't want to walk across to the other building. So really everybody's already using kind of these remote working tools on a daily basis anyway. So I didn't feel that out of place using all the same tools. I felt like I was able to keep up. And now, of course, yeah, it's the world that everyone lives in. So.
Right. Well, that's one step further than I remember in San Francisco. I was actually, I think, on the same block as the Instagram founders. I was on Second Street, you know, around the same time, 2010. But you know, it's even if I'm sitting right next to someone, I would send them a chat message, because it's rude to poke someone with headphones on in the middle of something, right? It's like, you know, unless it's lunch, like I don't want to get poked on a question. Just like, you know, toss it in my chat thing and I'll.
Right.
So now here we are, you know, extending that out. But you know, yeah, it makes sense, right? It takes however many 10-15 minutes to get into a flow state anyways, and if you're constantly being interrupted, even if you're right there, yeah, it's rude to poke a coworker.
Yep, right.
So, Carlton, can you take us out?
Well, all I can say, Carl, is thanks for coming on. It's really interesting chat, and love to get the back story, and then, you know, the story of Instagram and how they grow up, and, you know, that's super. Thanks for coming.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a pleasure. I've really, really enjoyed the conversation.
Well, as ever, we are at djangochat.com, chat Django on Twitter. Were you going to say something, Carlton, or did I talk over you?
No, I was just going to say join us next time.
All right. Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, guys.